This is probably the best-known blues song in the world, St. Louis Blues. It was written in the early 1900s by a guy named William Christopher Handley. Countless publishers turned Handley's Cuban-style composition down. Finally, it was purchased in 1914. But it only became a hit in 1917 when white singers took it on. After that, it became the first record album to sell over 1 million copies. It was a favorite of Queen Elizabeth. In the 1930s, when Ethiopia was invaded by Italy, the Ethiopians adopted this St. Louis blues song as their battle hymn. Most important to me, it was one of Lee's favorite songs to play on the piano when he came home from work. H. Lee Turner was born in 1927, when Kansas was growing up from its Wild West and pioneer roots, full of small farming towns and possibilities. He came from a poor but close-knit family. He went on to become one of the most famous trial attorneys in America. Lee was also the husband of Betsy and the father of 6 kids. I'm one of them, Shelley, and Cindy is another. In 1995, Cindy and I interviewed Lee about his growing up years, the Great Depression, the Kansas Dust Bowl, and his days in high school and college, working to build airplanes for the war effort and working on the railroad. Now here are these stories, starting with Lee talking about a dog he and his cousin Melvin had as a kid. The dog was named Fritz. Fritz helped defend the 2 kids from a mean cousin, or maybe it was an uncle named A.C.
A.C. knew that if he hit Melvin, that Fritz would chew him up.
Wow. That's a good dog. Yep. Who's your best friend as a boy?
Melvin. Oh, my cousin Melvin.
Mm-hmm. What was your favorite holiday?
Christmas.
No Halloween?
I liked Halloween.
Well, what was your favorite Christmas? Or what was the most memorable one?
Well, I remember the Christmas of 32. We were desperately poor. And they'd built a new house at Dodge City, out in the country. And they'd pulled the carpet off of the living room floor and hung it between the living room and the rest of the house so they wouldn't have to heat the living room. But in the living room was an evergreen tree with no ornaments. But when I woke up on Christmas morning, there was a red rubber ball under that Christmas tree for me. Santa Claus had come.
Was that your favorite Christmas, too?
Which made it okay, sure. Mm-hmm. Now, my mother, when they had even a little bit of money, would bake enormous amounts of cookies and candy and stuff. I told you that most of it seemed to disappear about 3 days after Christmas. Yeah, and I'm talking about mountains of stuff. And one day in April, this had to be about 1938 or 39, I saw Evelyn coming out of her room, which you were never allowed to go into, eating a piece of divinity. And so after she left, I sneaked into her room, opened the drawer, and there was a drawer full of Christmas candy.
Well, what all was in there? Divinity and?
Divinity, fudge.
Was it getting old?
Yeah, but it was still there.
So divinity, fudge?
Three, 4 months after Christmas.
Peanut
brittle.
Sugar cookies?
Yeah, well.
Those
I think she'd
cold,
eaten
right?
all those. Yeah. She'd eaten all those. But there was tons of candy
in
there.
Did you confront
her?
Uh-huh. And she said?
She denied it.
Did you tell
She denies
your
it even
about
today. It? Yeah, and she believed Evelyn. But even today, Evelyn tries to deny it, but she won't look you in the eye.
What about the story about the ice cream cone?
No, save that one.
Well, we're recording.
Are we?
Yeah.
Oh, are we recording now?
We're recording right now.
Okay. In 1934, Betty Ann was 1 year old. Okay? And that was in the heart of the Depression. And we were living at Kinsley then. And I remember the car was parked diagonally on the north side of the street, and the drugstore was on the south side of the street. And L.O. spent 5 cents to buy her an ice cream cone. I was 6 years old at the time. And she ate the ice cream cone, and I understood it was her birthday, but I really didn't like it because an enormous amount of the ice cream cone dripped down on the pavement. And I thought that was a terrible waste. Okay?
Mm-hmm. What were your parents really strict about?
Well, let's not talk about the strictness in... Let's see, I was born in 1927 mm-hmm. on Southeast 5th Street at home at Newton.
So I was born at home.
L.O. was a fireman on the Santa Fe Railroad. When he got out of the Navy, he became a fireman on the Santa Fe. And, it was shortly after that, they bought a house on Magnolia Street in Newton. And... I recall when I was a little past two that he kept saying that I could go fishing with him if I had worms. And so I spent the day searching for worms, and I put them in my pockets. And at the end of the day, I would have a ball of worms in my pocket. But I don't believe we ever went fishing. I also remember Evelyn confirms that I had to be not over 2 1/2. I remember at that house, we had a telephone with the receiver on it, and I pick up the receiver and say, I want to talk to my mommy. And the operator kept saying, little boy, hang up, little boy. And I refused to hang up, and I must have had this hang up, little boy, for 5 minutes, because I thought that that would be the way to find my mommy. And I remember precisely where the phone was in the house and so forth. You know, I've got a very early memory. And then when just about 3 years old, L.O. decided that he would bid in a branch job from Dodge City to either Pritchett, Colorado, or Boise City, Oklahoma. And he would buy some land and build a house on it. And... that would provide food and so forth for the children, and they could have greater savings. So they built a house, a brick house, on the Fort Dodge Road, and tried to farm there. And shortly after that, it was the Depression hit. Kindergarten, I went to a school at Dodge City, and... Evelyn and Edwin were considerably older. Evelyn is 3 years older, Edwin 7. And after school each day, I played with some black boys. Okay? You have to understand, my mother believes that when she goes to heaven, where she, in her beliefs, is right now, that there would be no black people there. But all of her pets would be there. And all of her relatives, and the blacks would have their own heaven. Well, anyway, she saw me, when she came to pick up, she saw me playing with these black boys who were second and third graders. And she says, called me over the car, she says, you can't play with niggers. And so the next day, they came to play with me, and I said, I can't play with niggers. Whereupon they beat me up. Every day for the next 2 months, I got beat up by these black boys, who I really don't blame for it, and finally dropped out of kindergarten because it was tiresome getting beaten up. Now, at the Fort Dodge house, mother's brothers, some of them came to stay with us because of the Depression. Others were in college at the University of Kansas. But I began to hear, when I was 5 years old, I began to hear talk about the Lindus Lumber Company was going to try to take our home away from us. And I recall that we had to go to court because of something the Lindus Lumber Company had done. And I didn't like the Lindus Lumber Company very well. And ultimately, they foreclosed on the house. And then we moved to Kinsley. I recall at Dodge City, on the home there, that I would hear on occasion my mother and father talking about where they were going to get food for the children the next day, which was a concern. But I don't recall ever going to bed hungry. One thing I developed a great appetite for was biscuits, and they called it gravy. And what they did is they'd take bacon grease, put some milk in it, and really it's pretty good, I thought then. But it was a very high calorie diet. Anyway, we moved to Kinsley. They had a, Mabel had a section of ground, sand hills, right next to the Arkansas River, and a house. And we stayed there. Ello did any kind of work he could to make ends meet. Ran a school bus route, had a few head of cattle. And about that time, which is a major problem growing up, Ello got religion. And I think Oral Roberts came through, these evangelists. And the one thing you learn from that is to detect phonies. And I would say by the time I was in the middle of the first grade, I became an expert on detecting phonies, particularly religious phonies. They demanded 10% of the gross of everything that he produced. If he butchered a steer, they came, they didn't want 10%. I think they wanted a quarter and got a quarter of it. At one time, they moved in to our house, a fellow named the Reverend Earl Spotts. That was in 1933. And that SOB was with us for maybe 4 or 5 months. Mother had to cook for him, and he got whatever he wanted, bacon, eggs, and so forth. She washed his clothes, and we had to put up with him. And then we were forced to go to church almost every day, every night, which got to be tiresome. Finally, we got to stay home, and my older brother proceeded to deliver sermons that he had seen at the sect churches. Oh. And so on and so forth. That went on through grade school when we moved to Newton. But when I hit junior high, I refused to have anything to do with it anymore and managed to stop it at that point. But I think some of the greatest phonies in the world are in these sect evangel. I remember one guy particularly. He shows up, he's an evangelist, he has a new Cadillac convertible, red, and he had an assistant who was a redhead, who he billed everyone as his assistant. But there were some complaints that somehow it was inappropriate for a man of God to be driving a red Cadillac. He said that's to symbolize the red blood of Christ shed on the cross for the redemption of all humanity, and they bought it. I felt that there was tremendous exploitation on the part of the religious people, of people who had come in desperate circumstances because of economics. Well, anyway, in Kinsley, let's see, in 1934, Ello was called back to work. He had been off work from 1929. And when he worked, he made very good money. But he was called back to work, and we first went to Hutchinson, where he worked that branch as a fireman. Then we went to Newton, where he worked the main line. And that went on from 1934 to about 1936 or 7, and the Depression hit again. and he was out of work. That coincided with tremendous dust storms. And the dust storms would roll in from the northwest in the spring, and day would turn to night. And if you were in school, they let out school, but that you didn't walk home. They had to take you home, because sometimes you couldn't see a half block. At that time, what did he do? He worked as a painter. He took any kind of job he could to make money to feed the family. And when we moved to Newton at that time, he bought a place on 201 Southeast 3rd. Do you remember that, either one of you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a pretty house.
And rebuilt it in 1938. And, of course, lived there to the time he died. But in grade school, I went to Washington School. And one of the problems with going to school there, I had great relations at Kinsley, where I spent the first grade and the first part of the second grade, and at Hutchinson, where I was there for 2 months. And you don't think about it at the time, but at the time, I was probably the smartest kid in the class, and really got along fine. But when I went to Newton, the church that we had to go to was just across the street from Bob Martin's house, who was in the same grade I was at Newton. So almost immediately, I got called a Holy Roller. And whenever I got called a Holy Roller, I got into a fight. And I probably fought every day through grade school with somebody on this Holy Roller business. And let's see, in the second grade, I got called New Boy by the teacher, which didn't help things a whole lot. And I remember another thing. I was great on singing. In grade school, I got a high school music pin, gold pin, by the director of the choir in high school, because she liked to hear me sing. And I don't know what happened to it. I think I lost it. But when I was in second grade, we were singing some song, and I was singing second, or harmony. And she stopped everything. She said, "Who is singing harmony?" And I thought I was in major league trouble. Not a word. And she three times said, "Who is singing?" All the heads turned and looked at me. And I thought I was in major league trouble. But she wanted me to take voice lessons and so on and so forth.
What song were you singing? Do you remember?
I think it was Santa Lucia.
You want to sing it now?
No, I'm not going to say Santa Lucia.
I'll tell you what. Your Ello and Eva both were musical. Eva played the piano?
By ear.
And what did she like to play?
Anything by ear.
Well, she played for the movies, right?
For the silent movies in Kinsley, where she grew up, she played the piano, mm-hmm. in return for which she got to see the silent movies in the early 20s.
And then Ello played the guitar with his friends?
Well, he came from Oklahoma with a violin, and then he took up the guitar.
What songs, I mean, when we were little, you used to teach us songs, and Sweet Chariot is one, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. I would sing that with you now, if you would.
No, I'm not going to do that.
Okay, what ones do you remember?
Oh, there are quite a few. The one about the tobacco guy.
Yeah. That goes.
You know, my grandfather taught me that when I was maybe 3 years old.
Okay, let's try that one.
No, I'm not going to sing that.
Well, I'm going to sing it then, and you can tell me if I've got it right or wrong.
Okay.
There was an old tramp, and he had a wooden leg. He had no tobacco, so he had to beg, said the tramp to the bum. "Won't you give a man a chew?" "No," said the bum, "that would never, never do. If you leave off your drinking and you save up your rocks, you'll always have tobacco in your old tobacco box."
That's it.
Okay, now how would you do a harmony?
Then he had another one. I didn't sing harmony to that. Then he had another one about a grasshopper sitting on a sweet potato vine.
Okay, I don't know that
but
one.
You know, my memory is pretty thin on him. He died in 1930 or 31 when I was 3 or 4 years old.
Now, who is this?
Abe, grandfather.
Okay.
Abe.
Mm-hmm. And did you like him at all?
Well, he was nice at the time.
Okay.
This was Eva's
dad? No, this is her father. He was raised by an uncle who was a judge in St. Joe, Missouri. And he had a brother. And so they say his parents left quite a bit of money to him. But when he and his brother got out of high school, the judge, who had married some younger woman, kept all the money for allegedly raising him, gave each one of them $100 and kicked him out of the house. And Abe went west at that point. And that had to be around 1875, something like that. He was a great horse breaker. And on the Oklahoma Strip run, he got a quarter of land, that's 160 acres, by Oklahoma City, and lost it gambling. He loved to gamble, play cards, drink, and his buddy was Wyatt Earp, who was also a gambler, a drunkard, and so forth, notwithstanding what's done in the movies. Mabel, his wife, hated Wyatt Earp, who she thought was a corrupting influence on Abe. And she was so bitter about the whole thing that when she died, she refused to be buried by him. He's buried in Kinsley, and she's buried in Great Bend. Okay.
What did you get into the most hot water for when you were growing up?
For anything that constituted alleged teasing of Evelyn.
Oh, alleged?
Teasing. You got in major league trouble.
Well, what kind of teasing were you doing?
I really don't recall teasing her particularly, but whenever, you know, she was 3 years older, whenever she felt she was being teased, she would call for Daddy, and Daddy would administer punishment for teasing Evelyn.
Well, what about the incidents where she got you with a pair of scissors?
No, she didn't get me. She got my older brothers, threw a pair of scissors and threw them right into his arm.
What happened to her?
Nothing.
Nothing?
She broke a bowl over my head once.
She finally admitted it. But she said you were running by her when she was at the sewing machine.
No,
you and
no.
The others were kind of picking at her as she was trying to sew, so she finally took a...
No, she was in the kitchen washing dishes when she did that.
Oh, but just out of the blue? Or?
You know, it's a funny thing. She was able to pound me until I got in sixth grade. And I'll never forget, she was trying to pound me, and all of a sudden... she realized I was stronger than she was. And in that split second, she stopped trying to pound me and started calling for Daddy, Daddy, he's hurting me. In that split second, she realized that it was time to change directions.
I'm going to skip to something that I want to be sure we talk about.
Okay.
When did you meet Betsy?
In college.
And what was it about her that made you think, this is the one?
Well, I dated an awful lot of girls. I met her in debate. You know, I was first team debater at University of Kansas.
Uh-huh.
And Betsy was out for debate, but on a purely amateur basis. And so she wanted to debate with me. And we debated, I think, the gold standard. Something about the gold standard. And she was trying to wing it. And she was really terrible on her argument, but was trying to bluff her way through. I started laughing at her, which annoyed her considerable. But after that, we started going together. And she told me that, you know, we could debate and so forth. You know, she was state champion in high school. And I told her I really had no interest in debating her, that I was going to take her out on a total different basis. So that's how it developed.
Oh, so she said, let's go debate. And you said, let's go date.
No, it wasn't like that. But anyway, I got her in Delta Sigma Rho. That's the honorary debate society because I was president of it. But Betsy was not much of a debater in college.
What did you like about her? What made you say, well, this is someone special?
Betsy's smart, as you know, and interesting. and non-boring. I never could stand to go with dumb girls.
Well, what made you decide to date a younger woman, though?
She's only 2 years younger.
I know, but that in our day and age, that was a no-no. You had to...
Oh, no. In college?
Well, yeah, kind of.
Oh, no. I was in law school when I started going with her.
Uh-huh.
No, 2 years younger is pretty standard in college.
What was your first date?
You mean, where'd we go and what did we do? I don't recall.
Do you recall the ice cream cone incident with her and the library?
Yeah, she was very studious. I was not. I made very good grades, but I didn't have to work at it too hard. And she was in the library. So I got 2 ice cream cones, went up in the library, and they were melting and dripping, and she couldn't continue to study with those, so we went out. She left the library.
Is it true that you'd sit on the steps of the law school and grade women's legs as they walked by?
No. Now, what you'd do, I was part of the great veterans after World War II.
Uh-huh.
And there was a tradition at Green Hall, the law school, that everybody would go out in breaks between classes and so forth and sit on the steps. And brave girls would walk by, and dead silence was embarrassing for them. And there were other people who made various comments and so forth, not on the legs. It was usually on the upper area. And like, pop your chest out and be proud. And sort of running the gauntlet type of thing. A lot of girls crossed over. More of them went right by Green Hall and then went through this tremendous wave of sound. And when I was a freshman in law school, we started the annual Law Day, which became a great institution. I was chairman of it, I think, and I wrote the skits, which was lampooning the professors. They were wildly popular, but the dean told me not to count on being able to come back the next fall. He did not appreciate the skit on himself. I was also chairman of the Beauty Queen contest, which we named Miss Race Ipsa Locator. And at that time, every sorority wanted to have any kind of a queen that they could talk about. So they put the girls out. I used as an MC a guy named Marvin Small, who was an all-Big 8 football player and had become athletic director at KU. And we were first going to do it with them in bathing suits out by Jimmy Green's statue in front at high noon when there was a big crowd. The dean heard about that. And he said we had to do it indoor at Green Hall or Green Theater. So we do it at Green Theater. Again, they're in bathing suits. Now remember, these were World War II veterans, most of the law students. And so the girls would start to come across the stage, shoulders back and so forth, and this wave of sound would hit them. And together with Marvin Small, and very quickly, their shoulders slumped forward, and they'd put their arms across their chests. Some of them would cry. But that was our queen contest. But we never had a dearth of candidates. They always were putting up new ones. Incidentally, those contests are all rigged. I always decided who was going to get the queen contest.
Ahead of time?
Uh-huh.
Did they know ahead of time
that
they were going to win?
No.
Did you get bribed?
Nope.
How'd you decide? Was it based on who was the most likable person or the prettiest one? Or?
Well, for example, in the third year, I threw it to the Kappa Kappa Gammas. So Betsy was Kappa Kappa Gamma.
Oh, so it was a political.
So it was all politics.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Did you think Betsy was pretty?
Uh-huh.
Was she pretty popular?
In what sense? With boys or girls or what?
whatever you think.
Well, let's put it this way. She was quite respected. She had a lot of boys who thought that they wanted to marry her. That type of thing.
And she...
Were you considered popular?
In some circles, yes. Mm-hmm. In college? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I got along quite well in college.
Now, you both were in plays at different times.
Not together, though.
Yeah.
I was in plays in high school. We were debate champions. When I was in the eighth grade, I got drafted into high school debate. And in 1943, when I was a sophomore, we were state champions. In 1944, Betsy's brother was on a team from Hutchinson, and they were state champions, but my team never lost a debate. It was the other side that lost that. Then in 1945, we were state champions again. And after I graduated from high school, the next year, Betsy was on a state championship debate team. Her brother was, I never debated him directly, but ran into him. He debated on the same side I did at tournaments. And frankly, I thought he was a pompous ass. And not a particularly good debater.
Yeah, did you debate with reference cards or just all off the top of your head?
Oh, in high school? Mm-hmm. You had a certain number of quotations that you used. Mm-hmm. But in college, I debated off the top of my head, hardly used any quotations at all, mm-hmm. debated logic. Mm-hmm. More the British style. Today in college debate, it's talking at 600 words a minute and reading nothing but authorities. Mm-hmm. Boring. Mm-hmm. Boring.
What is your favorite thing about, what are your favorite things about your children?
What do you mean, favorite things?
What do you like about your kids?
I'd like to have them around.
How about your grandkids?
I'd like to have them around. You know that.
What are you the most proud of about your children?
Well, pride's a funny term. I've never been much on pride. I like the fact that our children dug in, worked hard, are bright, and learned. Basically, I like the children as people and the grandchildren as people.
Do you like the impishness of your grandchildren?
Well, you know, that's part of it, but you know, Betsy and I would rather have children and grandchildren around than anybody else, although there's other people we like. Lawyers, you know, I get along awfully well with lawyers around the country.
Now, I remember since I went to Shady Grove that you always used the term that the younger half of the family was earthy, and sometimes the kids were earthy. Were you ever earthy when you were a kid?
Uh-uh.
Never?
Uh-uh.
Ever?
Got my mouth washed out with soap.
For what?
Anything even bordering on that.
Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? What do you mean as earthy?
Well, you know what the earthy is at Shady Grove.
You told a story about G-strings, though.
In high school?
Yes, for the commencement or something.
Yeah, but...
Well, how does that one go?
My debate coach. You know, I think I got that from her. And then she was shocked that I used it for the senior banquet. But the way the story goes is... my speech was about working hard to achieve, okay, and surmounting difficulties. And I told the story of Pagliacci and his violin. Pagliacci was the world's greatest violinist, and he was doing a concert in Italy. And as he played, the souls of the listeners was carried back to the old country, beyond the sea. They heard the lapping of starlit shores on the Mediterranean, the lilt of nightingales in the vineyards of France. As he was playing, however, the audience was electrified by the sound of a breaking E string. Undaunted, Pagliacci played on. The A string breaks. he plays on. The D string breaks, he plays on. But on that one string, he played the greatest concert of his career. I described the concert. I said, as seniors, I said, we go into the world. I said, we may lose our E string, but we must persevere. We may lose our A string, our D string, but we must persevere, as did Pagliacci. And if we persevere sufficient in life, we can make that G string cover much.
And that's when you got in trouble.
Well, it was a pretty puritanical school.
Well, Betsy has some questions in here that she marked with red checks.
What are they?
What was your biggest challenge? Was there something that you just did not want to do but had to go ahead and do anyway? How did it turn out for you, and were you victorious?
Well, in any type of contest, I do my best to win. And whether that's engaging in a schoolboy fight or trying cases in law and so forth, I have, how would I say, a very strong compulsion to put it together and come in first.
What's the strongest example of that for you?
Well, in law, you know, I have my win ratio in jury trials about 99-1.
Now, you know, stronger. What's interesting is that all the your siblings seem to have that same very competitive characteristic to them.
Siblings?
Yeah, your siblings.
No, I wouldn't say that.
You don't think so?
Certainly not true of Betty, or Dan, or Edwin. Evelyn has more push in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But
where did that come from in you? I mean, who instilled that?
Who knows? Who knows?
I was going to ask what his first full-time job was.
Well, that sounds fine.
Okay.
I started in grade school carrying papers. And then in 1940, I was 12, before I was 12, my first full-time job was working as a stock boy at Woolworths. And that was in an unair-conditioned second floor, hot as hell, 12 hours a day at 7.5 cents an hour. And if they caught you sitting down, you were fired. But that was a good job for a kid that age, and there were lots of people, probably 100 other kids that'd like the job if I lost it. And to give you a comparison, grown men married with families made 18 cents an hour, okay? After that, I worked in a Goodyear store. Remember, this is World War II, and most able-bodied men were gone. I worked in a Goodyear store where I changed tires and did everything in the store, sold the goods that they had. I think I did that for 2 years. Before I went to work at Woolworth, L.O. built a popcorn stand that he wanted Betty and Edwin and Evelyn to run. They refused to run it. So when I was probably the fifth and sixth grade, I spent the summer running the popcorn stand. And after school, until about 9 o'clock in the evening, running the popcorn stand, which was a really pretty bad thing to have a kid do that age. Okay, what else?
What's the biggest bargain you ever bought?
That's hard to say. Some of the land I bought has been a bargain. What I consider bargains, other people may not.
Such as?
Well, the place in Hawaii. That cost a lot of money, but I thought I got a pretty good price on it.
What did you spend way too much on?
You mean overpaying?
I guess so.
I'm not sure I overpaid on anything.
Okay, what was your most foolish purchase?
Well, I really can't think because I've kept most everything I've ever bought.
Okay, here's the next ones. These are all checkmarked. This is why I'm asking. Would you say you have a philosophy of life?
To do your best at whatever you start to do.
Are you easy or difficult to get along with?
In my opinion, I'm easy to get along with.
Let's see. What else is in here?
It was just like Ray Dillon once was telling a group of people at Hutchinson that he respected a man who set forth his own opinion. Louis Oswald, a local lawyer, says, "That's right, Ray, only so long as he totally agrees with you."
Betsy has marked in here somewhere, what are your religious beliefs? What do you believe in?
Well, you know, I have studied theology. I read an enormous amount on it. The Golden Bough is probably the best book to read to understand that all. If you use a word to classify, I'm an agnostic, which simply says that I believe there's a higher being somewhere, but I sure don't understand who he is or what it is, and I don't believe man is in the image of that higher being, but that I guess what you could say is I believe that the only true religion is seeking after the truth, and it's an ongoing situation, and I don't believe that at any stage of history someone has discovered 100% the truth and you put it in a box and that becomes absolute for all time. I think there's a progression of understanding on the part of mankind. Let's say in terms of the understanding of what it's all about, maybe 1/1,000th, to give you some idea of how far I think that we have to go. Okay, what else?
Well, I was going to ask a question about Halloween.
About what?
Halloween.
What about Halloween?
Well, just, you know, thinking in terms of the kids and that being their favorite holiday, how would you remember Halloween?
I always liked Halloween. We would go out to trick and treat when I was little, and there was a lot of severe mischief back in those times, like privies would be turned over or transported to different parts of town. There was a fair amount of vandalism at Halloween, but it was always... The thing you liked about Halloween was that the heat of summer was over, and the autumn was there, and the leaves were very pretty, and it was a good time of year. The idea of spirits and ghosts and so forth was... you kind of liked that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in fundamentalist religion, they were strong in belief of demons and things like that. While I never really believed in them, I was somewhat nervous about them. Okay, what else?
What kind of costumes did you wear?
None.
You just went as yourself?
Just a mask. You'd put on a mask.
Uh-huh.
I don't think anybody wore costumes back in those times.
When you turned over the privies, was there somebody in there?
I didn't turn over any privies.
Okay. Well, okay. Just so I understand, was there somebody usually in there when that happened?
No. Well, maybe. I don't know.
Okay. All right. I think we need to talk about railroad days. When did you start working on the railroad, and then your favorite stories you want to share?
When I was in high school, and I think my sophomore year, Evelyn worked at Boeing, and Chet, her husband, was a general foreman at Boeing at Wichita. They had 45,000 people working there building B-29s. And that may have been about the only place they built B-29s. But anyway, she got me on that summer as a messenger in personnel. As a messenger, you wore a black or a red badge. And the badges you wore determined where you could come and go in the plant because there was great security. And usually you were confined just to your department. But with the red badge, you could go virtually anywhere because you were carrying messages throughout the plant, which was huge. You were transferring people and so forth. So I spent the summer walking at a very fast pace throughout the Platte and knew lots of people there. And one time I crawled into a B-29 just before they were getting ready to take off and fly to the South Pacific. they caught me in time, which was fortunate for me. But for example, when they built the wings, they hired midgets and dwarfs because they could work inside the wing structure. And you'd see this army of midgets and dwarfs working on the wing structure. And I would say maybe 70% of the people that worked there were women at Boeing. And you would go in early in the morning. I was on the morning shift. I rode with Evelyn and Chet. But you would go into these tunnels, and you'd have 15,000 people in these tunnels waiting for their turn to go up and relieve the what they call the swing shift or night shift. And everybody was smoking and drinking coffee and radios. And you know, I can still smell the damn smoke and coffee as I think about it. And these hordes of people that were crammed in there. At that time, I imagine probably 60% of all or more, maybe 70% smoked. It smelled like hell. But anyway, I enjoyed the summer.
This concludes part one of our interview with Lee, which Cindy and I did in 1995. Part two of this interview is on CD number 2. You can go to it right now, or if you're curious, here's another version of one of Lee's favorite songs, St. Louis Blues.
I hate to see that evening sun go down. I hate to see that evening sun go down. Cause my baby, he has left this town. Feeling tomorrow like I feel today. If I'm feeling tomorrow like I feel today, I'll pack my trunk, make my ease away. St. Louis, old man, with a diamond ring. Pull that man around my apron string. If it won't fall powder and the stove-bought hair, say the man I love would not go nowhere. Heart like a rock cast in the sea. Or else he would never go so far from me. I love that man like a schoolboy loves to pipe. Like a Kentucky cutter loves his camp and ride.